We need to use our reason to assess the facts properly and to keep our priorities straight. To act coherently, much less morally, we can't lose our heads. We have to be able to reflect on what we are doing. When people disregard the moral judgments that emerge from reflection, we rightly view them as morally flawed. And when they willfully refuse to engage in reflection at all, when they rush to action without any use of their reason, we should judge them similarly. So when Anakin tells Padme, "You are asking me to be rational. That is something I know I cannot do," he is admitting to a great moral failing. If we willfully ignore what reason tells us, we become controlled by every whim of our emotions, and we lose our capacity to make moral decisions. Anakin's recklessness is then a vice. Yet, all Anakin's reckless actions pale in comparison to what he does to the Sand People who have captured his mother. Even from Naboo, Anakin feels his mother's pain, and he rushes to Tatooine to help her. But when she dies in his arms, he destroys an entire village, the innocent and the guilty alike, out of revenge. It's an act of unspeakable cruelty. Oddly, the horror of this act is downplayed in the movie. Padme only seems to feel sorry for Anakin, reacting little to the depths of the horror. She consoles him, and rather lamely insists that, "To be angry is to be human." Anakin himself seems to feel sorry for what he has done, but even this apparent regret seems to be more about failing his ideal of a Jedi than about the act itself. Indeed, he seems much more upset that he couldn't save his mother, and so vows to be all-powerful so that he can learn to stop people from dying. We could try to argue that the killings, though horrendous, are at least somewhat morally ambiguous. We can distinguish between dispositions and character traits that lie behind an action and the consequences of the action itself. As Mill puts it, the motive has nothing to do with the morality of the action, though much to do with the worth of the agent. We can then argue that Anakin, by acting out of love for his mother, is acting from a good disposition. A world in which people love their parents and their children so much that they are willing to go to great lengths to save them is a morally better world than one in which people lack such feelings. People are more likely to develop a strong moral character and to have richer lives in general when they are capable of such great and unconditional love for others. The development of such attachments is thus a great moral good. The hatred Anakin feels towards the Sand People, we could then argue, is a natural outcome of having such a great love. They have slowly and painfully tortured Shmi, and Anakin reacts passionately and violently to their brutality. So although destroying the Sand People was wrong, we could argue that Anakin's reaction is a byproduct of a character trait that is generally virtuous. We could then still think of Anakin as a good person. What Anakin does, however, can bear no such justification. First, to massacre many for the sake of one is egregiously disproportionate. Indeed, to kill any innocent person just to save a family member is morally dubious. We should always act so that we treat humanity, always as an end in itself and never as a means only, as the great Prussian philosopher Immanuel Kant puts it. By sacrificing innocent people to save our loved one, we are using them merely as tools for our own purposes. We do not respect them as full human beings with their own goals and values, but as something expendable whenever they get in our way. Moreover, to do so when those actions will not even help our loved ones treats the Sand People in just the way Anakin thinks of them. "They're like animals, and I slaughtered them like animals." Anakin's capacity to treat people as mere beasts is such a fundamental moral flaw that his capacity for love can't redeem his character. Second, and more importantly, for all the good it creates, the love of family is not always a good moral motive. Certainly, love is a powerful motive, and it can be difficult to control. In addition, the capacity to love is itself intrinsically good, and it thereby creates a great good in people's lives. Besides being good in its own right, it can also help to generate other goods. It teaches us to look at the world from the point of view of others, and to take into account the interests of those outside us. Yet, despite its great potential, love can also be morally selfish. Han, remember, is a better person because he loves, but his moral perspective is still limited. When we focus our attention exclusively on those we love, we can become blind to the anguish of others. They can cease to exist for us morally. Indeed, too often, we fail to think of outsiders as human at all. The exclusive love of our own families and our own groups is the root cause of the intolerance that leads to too many of the great crimes committed by humanity. So, Anakin's love makes his anger understandable, but what he does with that anger is no less horrible because love lies behind it. Anakin's murder of the Sand People is, then, in no way morally ambiguous. It's simply the first of Anakin's many future acts of barbarity. We are supposed to see Anakin's actions as a result of his all-too-human love for his mother and hatred for those who harm her, a flaw that will eventually lead him down the path to the dark side of the Force. In fact, however, he is far along that path the second he kills those innocent villagers. Only R and Padme's sympathy for Anakin as a character prevents us from seeing that he's already an agent of evil. If Anakin as a young man is not morally ambiguous, we could argue with some justice that once he becomes Darth Vader, he's more ambiguous than we might think. First, Vader's motivations are not entirely bad. He asks Luke to join him so that they can destroy the Emperor and rule the galaxy together as father and son.
With our combined strength, we can end this destructive conflict and bring order to the galaxy.
Vader seeks peace and order for the galaxy, ruled by the wise leadership of a single man, or perhaps a single family. Here Vader expresses Anakin's earlier sentiment that we need a system where the politicians sit down and discuss the problem, agree what's in the best interests of all the people, and then do it. And if people don't agree, he continues,
then they should be made to.
Even then, it doesn't bother Anakin that such a system sounds like a dictatorship. Well, if it works, Anakin could be seduced by the dark side, because although he wants the world to be a better place, he refuses to absorb the lessons of his wiser, if less talented, teacher. As a result, he doesn't appreciate how naive his view of the world is, and he can't control himself when he confronts the traps, like the one on Tatooine, that Darth Sidious sets for him. His good motives are thus put to evil use. Second, we could argue that Vader is morally ambiguous because Luke does, after all, feel the good in him. Faced with the torture and the destruction of his own son, he destroys the Emperor instead. What goodness remains allows him to resist the absolute evil of the Emperor, but only when his own son is involved. His motivations in killing the Emperor are not that different from his earlier motivations in killing the Sand People. He acts out of love for a member of his family. But as we have already seen, killing others for the sake of a family member is not always, or even usually, morally praiseworthy. So his motivations don't make his actions here better. What does make it better is that this time at least, he kills only the guilty. And he does so when it's the only way to save the innocent person who happens to be his son. The fact that in saving his son, he also kills the Emperor and helps to destroy the Empire that has tyrannized the galaxy is an important added bonus. It is then a morally good act, even if the motivations behind it are not entirely praiseworthy. So oddly, at the end of Return of the Jedi, Anakin finally does become a morally ambiguous figure. He does great good, even if the motivations are not entirely good, and even if they do not begin to atone for the great evils he has done in his life.
You know what they're up against.
Moral ambiguity can appear in a number of surprising places. It emerges when characters are basically good, but have to learn to get outside their egoistic tendencies, like Han. It can be found where evil characters pretend to be good to use the goodness of others against them, like Dooku. It appears not when people with whom we empathize, like Anakin, do horrific evil, but when good manages to eke its way out of an evil character, like Vader. Most importantly, it can appear when seemingly easy decisions, like Lando's, are given their full due. Most moral decisions we make in our lives are relatively easy. We help a friend with a project. We give up a concert to see our daughter's recital. We give directions to a stranger. Few decisions require us to consider anyone outside a small circle of acquaintances or the strangers who present themselves to us. These decisions are so ordinary that we hardly think of them as moral decisions at all. But the ease with which we handle most moral situations can leave us ill-prepared to think about the difficult moral decisions which may confront us and which could prove to be the crucible of our moral characters. A rare few of us may be blessed with a strong moral compass that invariably leads us to the right path, no matter how confusing the signs might be. The rest of us can only prepare ourselves by thinking about our possible reactions to many different situations, so that we can know how we should handle ourselves when the time comes. Thinking about it is not enough, of course, but it's a necessary first step to facing any challenge. In thinking about the moral ambiguity of the seemingly black and white universe of Star Wars, we can see how morally complex a simple world can be, and we can begin to prepare for the moral complexities of our own less than simple world.
Part 2.
Try not. Do or do not.
Ethics in a Galaxy Far, Far Away. Chapter 5. The Aspiring Jedi's Handbook of Virtue by Judith Barad.
So you'd like to be a Jedi Knight?
Surely a good part of the appeal is the adventure, the excitement, the glory of this undertaking.
But wait a minute.
When Obi-Wan Kenobi attempts to persuade Yoda to train Luke, the diminutive Jedi Master objects that Luke isn't a good candidate for training because all his life he has craved adventure and excitement. In Yoda's words,
a Jedi craves not these things.
The path to becoming a Jedi lies within. Suppose you're not deterred. You still want to be a Jedi Knight just as much as you wanted to be the first time you saw Star Wars. As a would-be Jedi student, you'll need to have a teacher. Yoda is probably your best bet, given his experience. For over 800 years, the small green master has trained Jedi Knights. But having identified a teacher doesn't mean that the teacher will accept you as a student. Being someone's student is a privilege, not an entitlement. Yoda will most likely examine your mental attitudes before he accepts or rejects you for training. He will insist that you must have the deepest commitment, the most serious mind. If you're committed and serious, there is one more prerequisite that must be met before training can commence. You must have the patience to finish what you begin. The process of becoming a Jedi Knight is definitely not quick and easy.
The Old Republic and the Older Republic. If you find these prerequisites within you, it's important to keep the underlying purpose of being a Jedi firmly in mind. The ultimate aims of the Jedi are peace and justice. When Obi-Wan first presents Luke Skywalker with a lightsaber, he explains that the Jedi Knights were the guardians of peace and justice in the Old Republic. If we really want to know about the Old Republic, we should turn to Plato's seminal work entitled, oddly enough, The Republic. Plato suggests that an ideal society should train a group of virtuous warriors to preserve peace and justice in the Commonwealth. It's true that Plato's Republic doesn't have the galactic proportions we see depicted in Star Wars, but much of Plato's teachings are reflected in the Star Wars galaxy. By comparing Plato's notion of a warrior class to the Jedi Knights and his Republic's guardians to the Jedi Masters, we can acquire a richer understanding of the Jedi. With this understanding, we will be more successful in living our life to the full, just as a Jedi should. Plato prescribes a long and rigorous period of training, which he thinks will yield knowledge of goodness and justice. Those who complete this training successfully, he insists, are fit to guard society, for they will have developed the virtues associated with goodness and justice. A central feature of virtue ethics is the claim that an action is right if and only it's what a person with a virtuous character would do in the circumstances. Plato thus emphasizes the development of virtues. An initial step in the testing that Plato requires is hard physical training for the future guardians. However, the purpose of this training is not simply muscular strength. Rather, it is undertaken to improve the soul, that is, the mind. Unless you train your body to obey your mental commands, Plato teaches, you won't be able to have within yourself the necessary power to drive you forward on the road to even greater mental control over other things. Proper physical training produces the virtues of courage and endurance. But training to the exclusion of intellectual development may make a person become hard and savage. Just glance at the wrestling shows on television, like WWE SmackDown. Just as Plato requires a training program that combines physical and mental skills, so does Yoda. The training you'll receive will probably be similar to the training young Luke Skywalker receives from Yoda, since you're probably nearer his age than younger Padawans. Throughout his training, Luke questions Yoda about good and evil, the Force, and other concepts important to a Jedi. Likewise, Plato's Republic features a question and answer interplay between teacher and students as Socrates' Padawans questioned him about justice and injustice, the nature of the good, and the ideal government. The first step in the Jedi training Yoda imposes on Luke is intensely physical. Its point is not only to increase his endurance, but to provide a crash course in Jedi virtues of discipline and persistence. By developing endurance, a Jedi Padawan has the capacity to work his way through difficulties, despite the frustration inherent in the task. One will learn to continue striving in the face of seemingly insurmountable obstacles and defeat. Endurance, requiring self-control, provides a Padawan with the ability to struggle over an extended time to achieve their goals. On Dagobah, the Jedi Master pushes his young student to the limit. Racing in and out of the heavy ground fog with Yoda on his back, Luke is winded as he climbs, flips through the air, and leaps over roots. Yet he endures and continues striving. A balancing act. The next step in Luke's training is to learn physical balance. He stands on his head while Yoda perches on the soles of his feet. Like the other physical exercises, this one also has a predominantly mental objective. It requires such great concentration that nothing can distract him. By maintaining his balance, Luke is in control of himself and the circumstances around him. Perhaps Plato's Padawan, Aristotle, can help us understand the importance of balance. To avoid being overcome by strong emotions, Aristotle recommends that we have the right balance of virtue, the golden mean. Here, all actions can be evaluated on a scale of excess to deficiency. Virtue is the mean, or the intermediate between excess and deficiency. It's a balanced action, responding to a particular situation at the right time, in relation to the right people, with the right motive, and in the right way. For instance, you can fear something either too much or too little. Fearing too much may lead to cowardice, as when Chewie ran from the Dianoga in A New Hope. Fearing too little, as was the case when Anakin rushed headlong to confront Count Dooku in Attack of the Clones, may lead to rashness, both undesirable traits. The balance trait, that is, the virtue between fearing too much or too little, is virtue. Suppose you face an ethical dilemma and fear making a decision because you have only incomplete information regarding the circumstances. You want to make the best decision possible, and so try to collect as much information as you can. But in reality, that's not often possible. Saddled with incomplete information, you may fear making a decision that might end up being wrong. But perhaps it's worse not to attempt to find a solution to the dilemma than to risk making a mistake, and so you rationally conclude that you shouldn't fear making such a mistake. Reason can help remove excess fear about being wrong, as well as inspire a proper respect for the gravity of the situation. By balancing too much fear against too little fear, you can attain the virtue of courage. We see this illustrated near the end of Luke's training period. Sensing that his friends are in pain and suffering, he asks Yoda, "Will they die?" But Yoda can't see their fate. Luke is in anguish. Both of his teachers, Yoda and Obi-Wan, counsel him to wait before going to their aid. If he decides to help them, he risks possible danger to himself. Yet if he decides not to help them, they may die. Even though Luke has incomplete information and is aware that he may be mistaken, he arrives at a decision, one that he has not reached lightly. He courageously decides to help his friends. So suppose you fear skydiving, but you learn to overcome your fear. If you decide to go ahead and skydive because you are essentially a thrill seeker, would this count as a courageous act? Well, Aristotle would applaud Luke's decision to help his friends as a courageous act. He would probably label your decision to satisfy your thrill-seeking desire as a rash act rather than a courageous one. What's the difference? Well, for Aristotle, the act of confronting danger or risk becomes courageous if and only if both decision and just cause enter the picture. The skydiving decision lacks just cause, which is essential to a courageous act. In contrast, Luke's decision, reached after serious consideration, involves a just cause, the lives of his friends. Yet the very notion of fear seems to oppose the Jedi teaching at its core. Yoda tells Anakin that he's not fit to begin training because of the great fear the young boy feels. The Jedi Master warns, "Fear is the path to the dark side. Fear leads to anger. Anger leads to hate. Hate leads to suffering." Yoda also warns Luke about anger, fear, and aggression. Does Yoda mean a Jedi should never experience fear and anger? His words could be interpreted in this way. But if we think about it, although the virtue of courage and the emotion of fear may seem to be mutually exclusive, they're actually quite compatible. The truly courageous person not only fears what she should when there's a reasonable basis for fear, but she can also stand up to fear and confront risk or danger. This is also true of anger, provided that anger is guided by reason. When Luke battles his father for the last time, as the Emperor goads Luke to use your aggressive feelings and to let the hate flow through you, he controls his anger when he realizes it will lead him to the dark side. He reasons that the only way to destroy the dark side is to renounce it. Yet his anger, controlled by reason, is what gives him the courage to stand up to the evil, powerful emperor. Throwing his lightsaber aside, he says with resolve, "I'll never turn to the dark side! You failed, Your Highness! I am a Jedi, like my father before me!" Not only is righteous anger compatible with courage, but it can also result in acting justly, another virtue. Feeling angry about someone's unfair treatment could lead you to take positive action to correct this treatment. For the Jedi, it's important to stop violent and abusive behavior and to defend the innocent against assault. Yet, if possible, a Jedi should use nonviolent means to accomplish this. It is true now that your emotions enable you to act more promptly and easily than merely reasoning about a situation. So, if controlled by reason, emotions can actually fuel the kind of virtuous action a Jedi should engage in. It's thus unlikely that Yoda's admonitions about fear and anger should be interpreted as meaning that a Jedi never feels those emotions. Rather, he probably means that a Jedi never acts from fear and anger. A Jedi acts when reason is in control, when he's calm, at peace, passive. In fact, as Yoda tells Luke, only a calm mind can distinguish the good side from the bad. In contrast, acting from an agitated condition clouds one's mind from knowing right from wrong. Anakin acts from uncontrolled anger when he sees his mother die at the hands of the Sand People. He confesses to Padme that, in retaliation, he killed them all. "They're dead, every single one of them, and not just the men, but the women and the children, too. They're like animals, and I slaughtered them like animals. I hate them." Padme attempts to console Anakin by reminding him that to be angry is to be human, to which Anakin responds sharply, "I'm a Jedi. I know I'm better than this." Entering the deep, dark cave. In order to succeed as a Jedi Knight, one must identify one's deepest fears and learn to overcome them. As part of his Jedi training, Yoda makes Luke enter the recesses of a dark cave, where he will come face to face with himself as he confronts the fearsome apparition of Darth Vader. When Luke enters the cave, he's ignorant of the nature of these fears. He doesn't know himself as well as he should. Clearly, this lack of self-knowledge can interfere with his self-control. It's difficult to control what you don't understand. Self-knowledge entails an understanding of our fears and other emotions, habits, and personal relationships. It implies an understanding of the possibilities that are open to us, as well as a realistic sense of our limitations. And it implies an understanding of our strengths, weaknesses, and faults. So when Luke enters the cave, as frightening as it is, he's given an opportunity for self-knowledge, a release from his ignorance of the hidden aspects of his nature. Similarly, Plato has a famous story about a cave of ignorance, the condition he thinks most people live in. Here, chained prisoners, unable to see one another, see only the wall of the cave in front of them upon which appear shadows cast by small statuettes of animals and objects that are passed before a burning fire by people behind a low wall. The prisoners believe that the shadows they see are all there is in the world. By this imagery, Plato wants to show us that most people are ignorant of their true selves and reality. Although they're deeply ignorant, the cave dwellers are content with the knowledge they think they have. Then, someone releases one of the prisoners. Standing up and looking around him, the former prisoner now has a clearer perception of the cave he inhabits. Yet the light from the fire, which he has never seen before, hurts his eyes. In other words, he is quite uncomfortable with his new knowledge. It even pains him, and he desires to return to his chained position. Aside from the literal experience of suddenly looking at a bright light, why would he experience discomfort and pain from learning something new? Well, looking at himself in this new light would force him to revise the familiar image he had of himself and of the world he's been living in. He may then have to change his former beliefs, values, and ways of doing things. Few people welcome this kind of change in their lives. Yet his rescuer encourages him to search further until he's finally freed from the cave's confines and attains a vision of the good, Plato's highest principle. Yoda, of course, corresponds to the rescuer. When he sends Luke into the cave, Luke first sees shadows of the truth, for the youth mistakenly believes that his deepest fear is Darth Vader. However, after decapitating Vader's image, he sees the severed head more clearly. The experience provides him with an alternative shadow to help him discover his true nature. Gazing in horror, he recognizes that the fate looking up at him isn't Vader's, but his own. Corresponding to the freed prisoner's first sight of the fire, Luke first recognizes his real fears. He realizes that he's afraid of becoming evil, fears that his weaknesses of unrestrained anger and impatience would prevent him from becoming the Jedi he yearns to be. These fears are based on his failure to fully trust himself to resist temptation. By realizing and confronting the implications of his fears about himself, Luke is liberated from the chains of ignorance. When Luke meets his father for the second time in a real battle, he succeeds in overcoming his anger and hatred by seeing the good in his father. His vision of this good results in forgiveness and compassion, such that he refuses to kill Vader. At this moment, Luke experiences the ultimate triumph of a Jedi Knight. The Jedi Knight resists evil, but does so motivated by a compassion that remains open to forgiveness and reconciliation. Both Luke's experience and Plato's story urge us to look beyond the familiar image each of us has of ourselves, so that we can be aware of our weaknesses. Being aware of our weaknesses, we are able to rectify them. Once our weaknesses are rectified, we will have the stability of character that is desirable both in a guardian and in a Jedi, since it enables them to remain unchangeable in the face of dangerous internal and external forces. If someone displays the character traits of justice, courage, and compassion to the extent that it has become a habit for them to act in these ways, they can be counted on to behave in these ways. They will rarely be influenced by conflicting self-interests or swayed by temptations, as Obi-Wan wasn't at all tempted to join Dooku to obtain release from captivity. When Obi-Wan refuses to join the dark side, he displays the virtue of integrity. Having integrity, he can discern what is right from wrong and act on what he discerns, even at personal cost. Just as the former prisoner in Plato's cave allegory at last sees the good, The successful Jedi must see the good in others, a recognition which motivates forgiveness and compassion. These two virtues drive out uncontrolled anger and hatred so that the dark side is no longer a threat. Forgiveness frees a Jedi to overlook transgressions made against him so that he no longer needs to carry around the burdens of resentment and hostility. Even without saying the words, "I forgive you," to his father, Luke's forgiveness of his father is clear as Vader lays dying in his son's arms. The right kind of love. The other virtue that's generated by seeing the good is compassion. Anakin, in an intimate moment with Padme, defines compassion as unconditional love, which is central to a Jedi's life. There's a huge difference between unconditional love and erotic or romantic love. In the scene where Anakin defines compassion for Padme, she's beginning to fall in love with him. Aware that he's very attracted to her, she asks Anakin, "Are you allowed to love? I thought that was forbidden for a Jedi." The young Jedi responds with his definition of compassion, distinguishing it from attachment and possession, which are both forbidden to a Jedi. The Jedi approve of compassion, a higher and more universal form of love, while attachment to a particular individual is frowned upon. Personal attachment to someone or something is an intense emotion, which can lead to fear of losing what one is attracted to. And we know already where fear leads. Compassion is a virtue. More precisely, compassion is a selfless love, involving a deep, cherishing concern for each individual as having intrinsic value. That is, individuals are valued for their own sake, regardless of their capacity to achieve anything else. Plato also seeks to prevent the guardians from having private attachments and possessions, which might conflict with wholehearted devotion to the public welfare. Since the guardians are servants of the Republic, they should have no temptations to neglect the public interest. They should have no land, houses, or money of their own. This approach avoids the corruption and conflicts that can happen when it's possible for authorities to place their own good above the public good. Plato maintains that the virtuous life is much more satisfying than personal relationships. It is so much more real than romantic attachments that those who live it will lose a great deal of the ordinary person's interest in sexual satisfaction. The very intensity of a guardian's universal love or compassion will make him less dependent upon particular attachments. The guardians devote as much of themselves as they can to public service. By forbidding romantic attachments, Plato hopes to free the guardians from the competition and jealousy of these exclusive relationships. More importantly, without romantic attachments, the guardians won't be tempted to prefer such private interests to those of the entire community. We see how Anakin almost puts his love for Padme above the safety of the entire galaxy when she falls out of a gunship chasing Count Dooku. Aware that he may be expelled from the Jedi Order, Anakin wants to rescue her, even if it means that Dooku might escape and the Clone Wars expand beyond Geonosis. Only when Obi-Wan reminds him that in such circumstances Padme would fulfill her duty, does Anakin agree to fulfill his. But does compassion for others necessarily require people to sacrifice personal attachments to concern for the larger society? Compassion is at the root of virtuous conduct. It is the notion that everyone counts. But to say that is to say that you count as well. And an individual may feel more fulfilled when allowed to love particular others and to be loved by them in return. At the end of Luke's training on Dagobah, he experiences an internal conflict between his commitment to becoming a Jedi and his loyalty to his friends, whom he senses are suffering. Loyalty is a Jedi virtue. For clearly, the Jedi should be loyal to one another, to their ideals, and to the Republic. Yet loyalty also entails an unwavering commitment to the people you value. It involves the subordination of your private interests in favor of their more pressing needs. Not only would Luke have been disloyal if he had ignored his closest friends in their distress, but he would also have lacked compassion. And it is the virtue of compassion that enables him to see through Vader to the good within him and to bring that goodness out. There's nothing inherently unethical about living in a way that enhances one's personal relationships. but neither does the advancement of personal relationships allow one to disregard the well-being of others or ignore duties. So perhaps the Jedi Order should allow family life, but prevent it from interfering with public duty. Is brainwashing ethically sanitary? One more problem about Jedi training requires some reflection. Part of Luke's training is to learn to control objects with his mind. First, he levitates a small rock, then his sunken X-Wing fighter. Now, if this exercise is meant simply to learn concentration, there would be nothing wrong with it. Concentration in itself is a valuable skill and a necessary one for a Jedi Knight. But eventually, a Jedi progresses from mentally controlling inanimate objects to being able to mentally control weak-minded individuals. The Jedi can use mind control to plan suggestions in weak minds, making them do things they wouldn't ordinarily do. For instance, at Mos Eisley Spaceport, a trooper demands Obi-Wan's and Luke's identification, but speaking in a very controlled voice and with a slight wave of his hand, Obi-Wan makes the trooper think that he doesn't need to see their identification. A much younger Obi-Wan used mind control to convince a young drug pusher that he doesn't need to sell death sticks, which look suspiciously like cigarettes, anymore, and that he should go home and rethink his life. Now, using mind control over others is a kind of brainwashing, a practice most people think of as horrible. But is the practice justifiable if it's used for a good purpose? The problem is that anyone who brainwashes or controls the mind of another believes that they are doing so for a good purpose. Can Plato help us out here? Plato sympathizes with the desire to influence weak-minded people. However, rather than directly controlling the minds of such people by the power of his own will, he uses the power of his thought to construct a myth designed to control the beliefs of the weak-minded by appealing to their imagination. The myth is this: the earth gives birth to people, so that all citizens are born of the same soil and must protect the land that is their mother. Additionally, some people have gold in their souls, the guardians. Some have silver, the warriors. And some have iron or bronze, everyone else. The type of metal that courses through each person will determine the role that they will play in the Republic. Plato suggests this influential myth in the interest of a higher purpose, namely the unity of society. Unity is achieved when people prove that they can bear responsibility and give up self-interest in order to fulfill the common good. Most people won't understand that it's important for each individual to subordinate their self-interests to the common good. But patriotism is easily inculcated by careful control of information, and it serves the same purpose of producing unity in society. Plato thinks that using a myth to mentally manipulate the weak-minded will encourage the kind of allegiance to the Republic that people usually feel toward their family members. So when the Jedi use their more direct mental manipulation for the good of the Republic, whether to fulfill a mission or reform a drug pusher, Plato would certainly validate this. Also, in Plato's cave allegory, the people who carry the objects that project the shadows on the cave wall are manipulating the minds of the chained prisoners. The weak-minded are always being mentally manipulated by other people. Since they dislike thinking for themselves or are unable to do so, they turn to others to figure things out for them. Family members, authority figures, the media, the rich and the powerful. You know, the Watto or Jabba the Hutt types, who interestingly are immune to such Jedi mind tricks. The weak-minded uncritically accept what such people want them to believe. Now, it's reasonable to believe that the overwhelming majority of mind controllers have their own selfish interests at heart, rather than the common good, when they put thoughts in the minds of others. Since weak-minded people desire others to figure things out for them, and since there will always be people willing to do so, isn't it better that the controllers be people who authentically care about the common good rather than people who seek to advance their own vested interests? The Jedi Model. Despite the problem of controlling others' thoughts, the virtues the Jedi possess make them great models to aspire to. As we've seen, in the eyes of an ancient Greek master and his Padawan, the Jedi would likely appear courageous, loyal, compassionate, just, and forgiving. They have endurance, otherwise referred to as perseverance. are mentally focused, and have a healthy humility. Also, the Jedi have honor. They live by a code or a set of principles, and find such value in so doing that they count it as a basis of self-worth. For a Jedi, honor is closely connected to one's role as a Jedi Knight, as defined by the Jedi Code. Further, the Jedi regularly manifest nobility, a desire for moral excellence that permits them to overcome personal interests in favor of some purpose larger than themselves. They show great stature of character by holding to the virtues that define them. Nobility involves admiration of the virtues of others and a desire to realize one's potential, or as the Army used to say, be all that you can be. Such admiration for the virtues of others and desire to bring out what is best in oneself are part and parcel of Jedi training. Due to their desire to perfect their own virtue, noble persons serve as good role models for others. Having the tendency to influence others, the noble person provides a persuasive example of what can be done in the service of goodness, peace, and justice, which are, after all, the ultimate aims of being a Jedi Knight. Being a Jedi certainly involves a lot of hard work. Fortunately, the various Star Wars movies have showed you how to awaken your inner Jedi. Just as fortunately, a couple of ancient Greek philosophers shed even more light on the process. Developing the kind of character a Jedi possesses may be far more rewarding to you in the long run than learning how to wield a lightsaber. So if you're still serious and have the commitment to be a Jedi, it would be wise to follow the examples of virtuous character illustrated in Star Wars and explicated by Plato and Aristotle. Chapter 6. A Wretched Hive of Scum and Villainy. Star Wars and the Problem of Evil. Christopher M. Brown. Why do bad things happen to good people? This perennial question has been especially troubling for philosophically inclined men and women who believe that some all-powerful, perfectly good being rules the universe. Why? Because a perfectly good being that has control of all things would presumably have created a world where good people are rewarded for their virtue, and evil people are punished for their crimes. Yet, good people often go unrewarded for their good deeds, and some even suffer terribly in this life. Meanwhile, bad people prosper. They even manage to attain the most prominent places of power. If goodness is more powerful than evil, why is there so much evil in the world? Could it be that evil is actually stronger? In The Empire Strikes Back, Luke Skywalker raises this very question while listening to one of Master Yoda's early lessons on the Force. Yoda warns Luke about the dark side, the path that Darth Vader has followed. Luke asks Yoda, "Is the dark side stronger?" Yoda responds, "No."
"No. No."
"Quicker, easier, more seductive."
Although Yoda answers Luke's question in the negative, his delivery suggests that Yoda is not certain, but at most only wistfully hopeful, that good will overcome evil in the end. Intelligent attempts to make sense of this apparent power that evil has over goodness in this life are bound to lead to more basic questions about evil. Why do bad things happen at all? What is the ultimate origin of evil? And what is evil anyway? Something wicked this way comes, but from whence does it come? There is genuine evil in the universe. This is obvious to most of us. Philosophers of religion, those who try to make sense of, support, or refute the claims of world religions, traditionally have distinguished two varieties of evil: natural evil and moral evil. A natural evil is an event that occurs in the universe that is painful, unpleasant, or destructive, and does not occur as a direct result of someone's choosing to do what is harmful. Examples of natural evils are Luke's being attacked by a wampa on Hoth, and bigger fish eating smaller fish on Naboo. Although it is good for a wampa to eat, Luke isn't too happy about the prospect of being on the menu that particular day. And though it isn't morally wrong for one fish to eat another fish, because the destruction of a living organism is something bad, at least for the fish that's eaten, philosophers call it a natural evil. In contrast to natural evil, moral evil results from someone's choosing to do what's harmful to either oneself or another. Grand Moff Tarkin's ordering the destruction of Alderaan, and Darth Maul's murdering Qui-Gon Jinn are prime examples of moral evils. But why do we live in a universe full of natural and moral evils? Maybe any serious talk of goodness in the world implies that there is evil in the world, too. Perhaps the relation between good and evil is analogous to the relation between light and darkness. Darkness is the absence of light, and light is the absence of darkness. In a world of perpetual light, where one would have no conception at all of darkness, the word light would have a meaning totally different from what it has for us, who dwell in alternating periods of light and darkness. Indeed, we might think that the words light and dark would have no meaning for us at all, in such a context. If good and evil are opposites in the same way as light and darkness, then in order for us to have any real experience that we might label good, we must also have genuine experience of evil. As Qui-Gon Jinn reminds Masters Yoda and Windu, the ancient Jedi prophecies speak of one who will bring balance to the Force. Harmony in the universe will not be brought about by destroying evil. Indeed, if good and evil are opposites, it may be impossible to destroy evil in the universe without also destroying the possibility of real goodness. The best state of affairs for the universe would then involve keeping the dark side in check, or balanced against the light side of the Force. There would be no need for Luke's courageous and selfless actions to save his friend Han Solo if it weren't for Jabba the Hutt's greed and inordinate desire for revenge. Nor would Luke have displayed the kind of compassion implicit in his refusal to kill his own father if Darth Vader hadn't been seduced by the dark side of the Force. There would be no cause for the kind of heroism displayed by the likes of Princess Leia, Han Solo, and Lando Calrissian if there were no evil empires to rebel against. It may be that the dark side serves a good and necessary purpose. There would be no genuine goodness in the universe without the dark side as an impetus for noble action. A universe without villainy, and therefore without heroism, would be morally lifeless, inert. We know evil existed a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away. But has evil always existed? If evil came into existence at some point in history, what was its cause? It couldn't come from what's truly good, for if goodness gives rise to evil, then it wouldn't really be good in the first place. It makes more sense to say that, like goodness, evil is simply a basic feature of the universe and has no cause. It has always existed along with goodness. Western philosophy offers this kind of dualistic account of good and evil in both non-religious and religious forms. The ancient Greek philosopher Plato articulates perhaps the most influential non-religious expression of a dualism of good and evil. He argues that the existence of a world such as ours, a world that on the whole is quite harmonious and orderly, must have a maker, a divine craftsman, and a plan that's followed in constructing the universe. However, any construction project requires more than simply a design and a builder. It also requires raw materials. For Plato, matter is the ultimate raw material of the divine craftsman's building project that is our universe, much as life forms the basis for the existence of the Force in the Star Wars galaxy. Yoda didn't create the raw materials from which his hut on Dagobah was constructed. The tree, sticks, and mud that he used to build his home pre-existed the finished product. Plato thinks the divine craftsman, as powerful and perfect as he is, works under the same basic restrictions. Although there hasn't always been a visible universe with planets, living things, and machines in existence, matter, the stuff out of which all these particular things are made, has always been around. The fact that matter is uncreated also explains why the world can't be perfectly harmonious and orderly according to Plato. Even if the divine craftsman necessarily creates the best world he can, this doesn't mean that such a world is an absolutely perfect world. Since the divine craftsman must create the visible world out of matter, and the matter out of which the world is fashioned isn't perfect, but is by its nature impure, disordered, and discordant. Let's assume that when Yoda did anything, even something as mundane as building a home out of sticks and mud, he did a great job. But even a home built by a Jedi Master is not completely impervious to decay at the hands of the forces of nature over time. Similarly, The visible world as a whole, with all of its evils, is the best that the divine craftsman could manage, given the limitations inherent in the raw materials he's got to work with. The Platonic tradition in Western philosophy has often considered matter to be not just limiting, but positively evil. Since matter is inherently evil, so are the individual bodies composed of it. Platonists look with suspicion on activities associated with the body, such as eating and drinking for pleasure, as well as sexual activity. Our bodies distract us from the more worthy pursuits of thinking and doing morally virtuous deeds. As Plato in the Voice of Socrates remarks, "So long as we have the body accompanying our reason in its inquiries, so long as our souls are befouled by this evil admixture, we shall assuredly never fully possess that which we desire, to wit, truth. In addition, we often identify ourselves with our bodies, when in fact, we're really spirits trapped in bodies." As Yoda teaches Luke, "Luminous beings are we." Yoda pinches Luke's shoulder. "Not this crude matter." In the Platonic tradition, evil has its ultimate source in matter, and this goes for moral evil as well as natural evil, since all moral evil originates in excessive attachment to the body. The good person is a slave to the body and its passions, and so she is excessively afraid of death. Obi-Wan's last lesson for Luke comes when he allows himself to be killed by Darth Vader, thereby freeing himself from the confines of the body, rather than have Luke watch him attack in order to kill. Obi-Wan warns Vader, "You can't win, Darth. If you strike me down, I shall become more powerful than you can possibly imagine." Obi-Wan's death allows him to be released from the limitations of bodily existence. In addition, Obi-Wan will have a power that Vader can't imagine, since Vader thinks, like his master, the Emperor, that real power comes with the ability to manipulate one's physical surroundings, particularly through the threat of death. For Yoda, Obi-Wan, and Plato, true power is spiritual power, having control of one's own self. The Emperor, by contrast, teaches his disciples to use the Force and channel bodily passions such as fear, anger, and hate in order to acquire power over nature and bodily death. As Anakin confesses to Padme after taking his first steps toward the dark side, "I should be all-powerful. Someday I will be. I will even learn to stop people from dying." By contrast, Yoda teaches that a Jedi uses the Force for knowledge and defense, never for attack. And he accepts the reality of bodily death. "Twilight is upon me, and soon night must fall. That is the way of things, the way of the Force." One all-powerful Force controlling everything. Many people don't accept the Platonic view that God couldn't have made a physical universe without evil because it conflicts with their belief that God is the omnipotent, all-powerful creator of the universe. On the other hand, the presence of evil in the world is often cited as evidence that there is no God, at least not a perfectly good and all-powerful one. As Han Solo says to Luke in A New Hope, "Kid, I've flown from one side of this galaxy to the other. I've seen a lot of strange stuff, but I've never seen anything to make me believe that there is one all-powerful force controlling everything." One of the most important religious philosophers to have grappled with the question of the origin of evil is the 4th century Christian philosopher St. Augustine. Although Augustine was raised as a traditional Christian, he did not fully accept the traditional form of the Christian faith until around 30 years of age. In fact, Augustine spent much of his earlier life as a member of an agnostic Christian sect known as the Manichees. The Manichees accept two Platonic ideas about evil. Evil finds its primary focus in bodily existence, and evil is a necessary feature of the universe. Thus, like Plato, the Manichees are dualists about the existence of good and evil. Both good and evil have always existed in the universe. Goodness doesn't come from evil, and evil doesn't originate from something good. However, whereas Plato traces the origin of evil to the universe as being material, the Manichees locate it in the will of a single person. The Manichees see the whole history of the universe as one long cosmic struggle between the forces of good and evil. Each of these forces has a kind of divinity associated with it, a good god of light and spirit, and an evil god of darkness and flesh. Personifying evil is one way of explaining why there is moral evil in the universe. Star Wars is replete with examples of such personifications. Darth Vader, the Emperor Darth Maul, the Emperor's Royal Guards, and so on. The Manichees think the evil that men do can ultimately be traced back to the evil god, a mastermind of all evil who is evil by his very nature. We might say that such a person is evil incarnate. One of the skeptical questions that the Manichees raise against traditional Christianity is this. If God is all-powerful and perfectly good, then why or how is there any evil in the world? A perfectly good God would not want to create evil in the first place, and an all-powerful God would prevent evil from coming into existence. But there is evil in the universe. So God is not both perfectly good and all-powerful, as traditional Christians suppose. This argument against the existence of God, at least the existence of a perfectly good and all-powerful divinity, is known as the problem of evil. Since the Manichees, like Plato, deny that the good God of the universe is all-powerful, they don't have to worry about the problem of evil. The Manichees, however, are left with a problem, or two, of their own. If one lets go of the idea that God is all-powerful, what reason is there to believe that God is more powerful than the forces of darkness? Might it not be that evil is stronger than goodness, as often appears to be the case in our universe, and to the characters in Star Wars? Recall Luke's question to Yoda, "Is the dark side stronger?" And Yoda's negative yet tentative reply,
"No.
No. No."
Quicker, easier, more seductive.
There's also Vader's constant assertion of the power of the dark side. Even if the dark side of the Force isn't stronger than the light side, as Yoda supposes, it might be that the light side has no real advantage over the dark side either. Bad things happen to good people, and many of these bad things will never eventually lead to anything good. One reason that religious believers defend God's omnipotence is that an all-powerful God can redeem the evil that occurs in this life by drawing from it more valuable goods. For example, a good person becomes even better as a result of suffering pain, whether psychological or physical. Why? She learns to better empathize with others who suffer. She more clearly realizes what's really important in life, not the pursuit of pleasure, but serving others. But this brings us back to the problem of evil. Why is there evil in the first place if God is omnipotent? Augustine argues that evil's presence in the universe is directly caused by the free choices of God's creatures, and not by God's direct choice. Human beings are created with free will, and, unfortunately, many of us have willingly chosen to do evil instead of remaining steadfast in choosing to do good. Although God could have prevented evil's actual presence in the universe by choosing not to create a universe at all, or by choosing to create a universe without creatures who have the ability to choose between good and evil, a universe with free creatures, even free creatures that do evil, is better than a universe that contains only mindless automatons programmed to always do good. That is why God created the universe, even a universe that carries with it the real possibility of becoming tainted with evil. But Augustine recognizes that simply saying that creatures have free choice doesn't fully solve the problem of evil. Where, then, does evil come from since the good God made everything good? Certainly the greatest and supreme good made lesser goods, yet the Creator and all He created are good. What, then, is the origin of evil? Is that the matter from which He made things was somehow evil? He gave it form and order, but did He leave in it an element which He could not transform into good? If so, why? Was He powerless to turn and transform all matter so that no evil remained, even though God is omnipotent? Augustine believes the answer to the last question is no. Unlike Plato's divine craftsman, Augustine's God created the whole universe out of nothing. This means for him there was no pre-existing stuff out of which the physical universe was formed. evil in this world can't be traced back to defective matter for Augustine. For matter isn't inherently evil, but good, since it too has its source in the perfectly good creator of the universe.
If once you start down the dark path.
Why did Anakin turn to the dark side? It's not as easy as it first appears to make sense of such a transformation. Did Anakin choose to turn to the dark side so that he is ultimately responsible for his fall from grace? Or did the devil, the Emperor, make him do it? If the Emperor is ultimately responsible for Anakin's turning to the dark side, then we may have found answers to such questions. But we're still left with the question of the Emperor's own allegiance to the dark side. Does the Emperor represent an incarnation of evil?